Good afternoon. My name is Courtney and I'm alcoholic. I'm really grateful to be here. I'm grateful for the opportunity. By the grace of a really loving God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship, which doesn't matter whether or not I think it was good. It was good because I haven't had a drink since July 20th of 2007. I'm not the kind of person that gets invited places. I'm certainly not the kind of person that gets invited back places. So this is a real treat for me, is what I think matters. I had a problematic relationship with booze, and I had a lot of people in my life tell me that I had a problematic relationship with booze. The church lady tried an intervention when I was younger, and my parents tried to let me know that I had somebody that I looked like somebody who had classic signs of addiction. Those frothy emotional appeal warnings fell on deaf ears. And so by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was well aware that the world thought I had a drinking problem and I had a problem with the world. And what happened for me was I got to find out that, like, for me, Alcoholics Anonymous was actually like really like the last house on the block, right? If there was a different way for me to do it, I would have found it and I certainly wouldn't have been joining you bozos, right? And so I used to kind of joke when I would give a talk about like how it's actually physically hard for us to make it to our first meeting, right? And I know that we say that because we're drunks and we're horribly drunk all the time. And for us to get from our step zero to our step one is a thing. But I also mean that because, like, it's weird that a lot of us meet in churches at nighttime, right? And so I had like countless experiences showing up to churches in the dark, looking for that one random door that's on the side somewhere. That's actually the thing that gets you in, right? And I've been thinking a lot about that because we're in this space together that's strange, right? And it's strange that we meet this way. And it's strange that, like, I can't see you face to face. Yet it's also really exciting that, like, we get to just, like, not have any borders, right? And so I'm focusing a lot lately on, like, the big book was written during a pretty tumultuous time. Right. And what does the big book say? The big book says that this is a design that works for us in rough going, right? And so I'm struck by remembering those things, especially today, because I moved from Denver, Colorado to Brooklyn, New York with my wife in August of this year. And I'll tell you this much, in my most graceful moments and in my smallest moments, the question is exactly the same. And that's, God, why did you put me in the middle of the eye of a global pandemic? Right. And so, in my small place, I will make anything my problem. I will make a global pandemic all about me. And in my most graceful place, I will ask the same question, which is, what purpose do I have? Right. And I can't tell you that I have this lightning bolt of clarity today that this is why God put me here. And it's all making perfect sense. I can't say that, but what I can say, and this is sort of like my intro into like why inventory is an important thing. What I can say is that God continually gives me an opportunity to grow spiritually. Well, how do I know that? I know that because I've been to a business meeting, right? I know that because wherever I go, there I am, right? So here's an example. So I moved, and moving in sobriety is a hard thing. We talk to each other about it's a hard thing. I listened to plenty of people, and so I figured I got the message, I got the lesson. I moved in sobriety, and it turns out it's a hard thing. And so what happened for me is like I walked into a very, very big meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in Manhattan, and I've never been in just a regular meeting of this size ever in my life. And this whole bit about like we ought not be organized. No, this thing's like a well-oiled machine. It's like a small city, right? And when the announcements comes, it's like you go over there for literature, you go over there for this service position, you go over there, you do all this thing. It's like something I've never seen. There's 500 people in this meeting. And then I hear this announcement about if you're celebrating a year sober and you want a watch, go see that guy after the meeting. And I hear this, and in my mind, what that means is that somebody is selling watches to newcomers, right? And I'm like, what? Like, it's like you get retired. It's like a retirement gift at GM or something, right? And so I got this resentment, like there's some guy making money off these newcomers, selling them wristwatches. You know, I'm on the phone with people back home in Denver. I'm like, you guys, I figured out why God wants me here. I got to tell these people what they're doing wrong, and I got to fix it all, right? Now, finally, somebody was gracious enough to go to coffee with me. And I said to them, what is the deal with the watches? And she just looked at me funny as I kept talking, and she was like, it's not a wristwatch. A watch is when you have a year sober, like the night before, they all like sit at a diner and people from the home group like come and visit and tell you really nice things about how you've grown spiritually. And we do it to like celebrate your first year of sobriety. So it turns out that it's like sort of this like sweet altruistic thing. But right, without help, I walk around thinking you're all got a problem and it's my job to tell you how to fix it. Right. So that's a lot like what my living sober problem is today. So there's a couple of things that happen in the steps, right, before I get to step four and step five. And so it's my experience that the big book's written like sort of on purpose. Right. And so some of the things that happen on purpose, I think, is one of which is like the first step. We get 44 pages dedicated to the first step. Right. That doesn't even count the pages that are numbered with letters. And so that seems to me like there's a real nice emphasis on like what the first step is, right? And what we get in the first step is we get story after story after story of man after man after man really, really struggling to get and stay loaded. And when that man is really not struggling to get and stay loaded, that man is really struggling to stay away from the drink or to modify those consequences, right? And so we have like a really well sort of illustrated picture of what alcoholism is. And it's been my experience that it's important for me to understand what it is that I have. And in the second step, instead of this like hard, 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 struggle, 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 the message becomes really gentle. The message becomes, you don't have any power. God has some power. And then what we're asked is we're asked to be willing to consider that perhaps there's a better way. We're asked to be willing to consider that perhaps there's a power greater than ourselves, right? And in the third step, we get to make this decision. And like the speaker before me articulated so well, is that like we get to make this decision to enter into this relationship, right? And it wasn't my experience that like I got to like read a document and sign a contract and have full knowledge of what it was that I was signing on to. My experience was I could not see a better way. My experience was that I was beaten down by alcoholism. My relationship with booze looked like the same thing over and over again. And it looked like I showed up to a fight. I knew I was going to lose. And there was absolutely nothing that could keep me from entering into that ring. I knew I was going to lose the fight. You couldn't keep me out of the boxing match. I just was beaten, right? So by the time I get to these steps, I'm like, okay. And they asked you questions, right? They asked me some questions. They said, are you willing to go to any lengths? Of course I said yes. Did I mean that? Absolutely not. Definitely I did not mean that. But I did mean that I was desperate in that moment to do what you told me to do next, right? And so I was fortunate to find some people inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life up until AA had looked like, Courtney, that's a real bummer you drove your car into the ditch, man. What are you going to do about it? But the people I found in AA, they said, what we're going to do is we're going to find out if the reason your car's in the ditch is the same thing that we have. And if you have what we have, we can definitely help you get your car out of the ditch. And they were gracious enough to tell me that that wasn't going to be the first time I drove my car into the ditch, right? So that's what I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found a solution, right? And so while I'm like having this solution, right, I experienced the third step. And for me, like my first experience with my third step is like, I sort of thought I was going to be like a spiritual lazy boy, right? That I was just going to like, you know, it's all in God's hands. It's all in God's time. I'm going to like let go. And that meant there was like very little for me to do. But what the book says is important, right? So what the book says is actually, like, before I read to get to what the book says, I do want to just like read what step four says. Step four says, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. And, you know, I got to be honest with you. I don't really like the way that sounds. I'm not really sure that I'm totally into that. Right. But you asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths, and I knew that the answer was yes. So I went ahead anyway. Right. And so what it says after the third step, very quickly after the prayer is written, we get one paragraph that editorializes it. And then the next paragraph, it says, next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which was a personal house cleaning. And it said many of us needed an overhauling there. And it said many of us haven't really ever done that before, right? So why is it that I come into Alcoholics Anonymous with a drinking problem, and now I have to enter into a relationship with a higher power, and then I have to make a list of all of my grosser handicaps, right? I just came in here because I can't quit drinking. But you had gained a confidence. The people who helped me have gained a confidence. Like, I believe that they knew what they were talking about, right? I believe that I could trust them, and I believe that they had what I had. So I'm willing to listen to them and to hear them out and to take maybe the next step, right? What was told to me is that they said, Courtney, the only things that you have to be here is honest, open-minded, and willing. And it's been my experience that that's actually the truth, right? And so what it says our liquor was but a symptom. So we had to get down to the causes and conditions, right? And so it also gives us a couple of examples after it says it was this, that it, after it says that we were at step four, it says that a business that doesn't take regular inventory goes broke. I can understand that intellectually. It also tells us that we did the exact same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out for the flaws in our makeup, which caused our failure, right? Now I'm finding this to be a little bit offensive. But it says being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us. Now, this was like a major news flash to me, right? When I came into AA, my story was really simple. If you had any idea what it was like to be me, you'd be so drunk right now. What that suggests is that my problems are of my own making. What that suggests is that it's self manifested in various ways that had caused my failure, that had that was the reason for my defeat, right? Now I'm at least curious, and I'm probably willing enough to put some things in some columns, if not for any other reason than to hopefully prove you wrong, right? But you've got my attention, and that's what my willingness looks like sometimes, right? And so the next part of the book goes on to describe resentments. Resentments are described as the number one offender. They do more harm, they destroy more alcoholics than anything else. And it says that from it stems all forms of spiritual disease. Okay, so here's what I think about steps four and five. I think this. I had been sober a number of years, and I was going through some stuff. And the stuff that I was going through was really hard. And what I mean by that is it was like I was having a human experience, right? And I found a new sponsor. And what that sponsor did to me is did for me, did with me, was I had a radical experience with the inventory process, right? So what does that look like? What do I actually mean about that, right? What happened for me is that I believe that, like, my experience in writing that inventory, I am directly grateful to that experience, because I don't believe that without that I would have recovered. I had written inventory before. I had made amends before. But without this experience, I don't believe I would have recovered. And here's why. Because my story was always, I'm Courtney and I'm pissed. I was a violent, volatile, blackout bedwetter. I had a problem with other people. I had a problem with personal relationships. I had a problem with vulnerability. I had a problem with how many problems you had about me. I always understood how I was angry. I grew up in a family where anger was modeled. I knew how to be angry. What I was taught is that when I am angry, I am powerful, right? I was never taught how to be afraid. I was never told that it's okay to be afraid. I was never told that fear was something that I was allowed to have, let alone navigate, right? And what the book says about fear is interesting, right? As it says, so resentment's our number one offender, and it destroys most of us than anything else. But what does it say about fear? It says it's the evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. That's my life story, right? I am just the victim of an ongoing train wreck, right? But the next sentence is like the trick, because it says, but did not we ourselves set the ball rolling, right? So these are things that are hard pills for me to swallow. So like, why don't I just get down to it, right? And so for me, there was like a miraculous thing that happened during the inventory process, right? And so there's a couple of things that I'm going to talk about like tactically that I think are important, but I'm going to try to also not just stay there, right? So when I'm writing an inventory, I'm writing about people and I'm writing about institutions and principles, right? And so I said, what's a principle? And they were like, okay, a principle could be like, love your neighbor as yourself. I happen to hate my neighbor because my neighbor was my mom and dad. That made sense to me, right? So I continue to go through these things, right? And so in the second column, what we're asked to do is we're asked to describe why we're resentful. And it's important for me to recognize that in that second column, I'm talking about actions. I'm not talking about traits. I'm really good at calling somebody names, but that doesn't do anything for me. What does a lot for me in my second column is if I think about really being honest, right? I'm not going to try to be any more recovered than I really am in that second column. I really want to give like the gruesome truth. So that means I look pretty unrecovered because I am, right? And that's something that I need to be aware of with time sober. With time sober, I can recognize that, yeah, resentment's not a good idea. I can also recognize that resentment's not a good idea is not a solution. But with time sober, sometimes I convince myself that I can just maybe ignore that, right? I can act as if, right? But without really looking at that stuff in inventory, I don't get to grow, right? And in the next column, the thing that's really helpful for me is this. And this is where I really started to have a different experience with it. Is that I look at what's affected in me, right? So how was my self-esteem, my security, my ambition, my personal or sex relations interfered with? And so I actually do like a pretty deep dive with that, right? So when I want to know how my self-esteem is affected, I start with two words and I start with the letters I am. What does this resentment make me feel like I am, right? When I look at security, I look at the same thing. What is it that I need or that I lack? Coming from that most fear-based place, if I don't get your attention, I'm not going to be okay. If I don't get that job, I'm not going to be okay. If I don't keep my health, I'm not going to be okay. That's how my security can sometimes feel threatened. Whereas my ambitions are actually like my healthy desires. What is it that I want? How is something or someone that I've been resentful towards actually having a direct effect on what it is that I feel like I want? And my personal and my sex relations. This is where I get to think about what are the huge generalizations I have about groups of people, right? I'm gay. And so a lot of times I'll have really sweeping generalizations about women, or I'll have really sweeping generalizations about lesbians, or have really sweeping generalizations about lesbian women inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, or I'll have really sweeping generalizations about straight people. Right. And again, like just looking at how those things are affected is important. And what I'm uncovering is to the degree that I am actually really affected. Because the thing about me is that when I'm angry, without this process, without my relationship with a higher power, I believe that I have to clinch to that anger because that's all I can get. Right before the third step, there's this description of the person who falls victim to the delusion that they can wrest satisfaction in this life if they only manage well. And to me, that's my living sober problem, right? So oftentimes the lie that I tell myself is that I need to protect this resentment, right? And that I need to stay in this angry place because it's the only power I can get, right? It might be crappy, but it's mine, right? And then after I see just to the precise extent that I'm giving power over, I'm giving freedom and happiness over to this resentment, after I look deeply at how those things, my self-esteem, security, personal relationships, sex relationships, ambitions, pride, how those things are affected, I know darn well that this is actually my problem, right? And that third column, that's what that does for me. It makes it really clear that this is my problem. I might be right about that person, right? About that person that I'm resentful towards, but I'm convinced that this is my problem. And so then I like look at like, where have I been selfish, right? It's not my part, it's my wrong, right? There are things on my inventory that if I were to go to a bar in the before time and sit down at that bar and cozy up to that bar and start a conversation with somebody and tell some normal person the exact truth about a person whom I'm resentful towards, there is 100% chance that that stranger is going to be like, wow, Court, you got a raw deal. You're darn right that person's wrong. The point for me is that I have alcoholism and I cannot afford that risk. So it's no longer an issue of me being right. The delusion that I can walk around with this and that I actually need it to be okay. The inventory process is where I get to start to find out, okay, what is my job? What is my creator's job? Creator does for me what I can't do for myself. The other side of the coin is that I got to do what I can for me, right? And so slowly these things start to unwind and unravel. And so already I'm starting to have a radical experience, right? I tell this really silly story sometimes, but it's a powerful articulation of like, in general, my spiritual experience. And I'm going to warn you that it's silly. So when I was getting sober, I dropped out of school and I moved back to Denver, and I entered into this strange period of time where my family was trying to take care of my alcoholism. This is not a suggestion. This is not a recommendation. This is a place where everyone in the LaDuke family became more sick. Okay. And so what that looked like is my older brothers are grown-ups. My parents are grown-ups. I'm technically a grown-up. And so they start asking this question, what are we going to do with you? I didn't have a good answer for that. I didn't have a lot going for me. But my oldest brother is incredibly hard of hearing. And he had just gotten a puppy. And he named his puppy his most spoken word. And his most spoken word was what? So I'm trying to get sober. I dropped out of school. I moved to Denver. Now it's my job to babysit the puppy named what? And so the puppy had had surgery, was just recently neutered, and I'm babysitting the puppy. And so I enter into 2 weeks trying to make sure that what doesn't lick his wounds. And what I do for 2 weeks is I repeat two words over and over and over again. And that's what? No. What? No. What? No. And here's the thing is if I had any idea how like prophetic of an experience that would be for my sobriety, I don't know that I would have stuck, right? I show up to the inventory process and I say to my sponsor, what? No. I say things like, where's the yeah, but column? And my sponsor says, what? No. Right? I start to get a plan for what I'm going to do about it. I go to that. I take that plan to my sponsor. What? No. Right? And so that's the thing that unravels here is I begin to start to have the spiritual experience. And I find that there's a whole paradigm that exists outside of me walking around knowing full well that I'm living in a world in which people have really wronged me. Right? You could not have talked me out of that truth. Just like when I showed up to Alcoholics Anonymous, I knew I was a liar. I knew I was a thief. I knew I had wasted tens and thousands of dollars of my parents' hard-earned money on an education I squandered. I knew that I broke my mother's heart. I knew that it was wrong when I showed up for Christmas with no presents and black eyes. These are things that were my problems. You couldn't talk me out of those things. But what happened was I showed up to AA and they said, hey, Court, What we're going to do is we're going to find out if you have alcoholism. And if what you have is alcoholism, we believe we can help you, right? So it's not as if those lying and cheating and black eyes and broken hearts went away, but they treated me at the source, right? So if I'm alcoholic, that means I don't have any power. That means I desperately need a process like the inventory process, because my disease isn't a game of just trying harder, right? My disease isn't just a game of I can write this stuff down on a piece of paper and then row a boat in a canoe in a lake and go burn it, right? My experience is that my fourth step has to be written and my fourth step has to be shared in the fifth step, right? And so we're going to talk about fears and we're going to talk about sex. But before I do that, I just also definitely want to read what the book says the fifth step is. So if step five says we admit it to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. Now, I'm kind of a word nerd, right? And so they told me that my fifth step was just reading my fourth step. But it says that my fourth step is making a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Don't say anything about writing it down in that step, right? And then in the fifth step, it says that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, right? I felt like four was a really different thing than five, but you guys are telling me one's write the thing and the other one's say the thing out loud, right? Why do I say all that? Well, because I can't even read the steps by myself. That's why, right? I can't even read the steps by myself because I'm going to do two different things, right? So in the fifth step, what starts to happen is I start to understand that, like, one, I'm not alone, right? And for me, what was really critical in that sponsor that I talked about, who helped me to see the same inventory strictly out of the book in an entirely different way, what I realized is I had been resentful. I had been angry, Courtney, right? I had been like like the doll where you pull the string and you watch it go. My whole life, people would just provoke me. Like they would just pull that string and then watch it go because it was entertaining. Because I'm the kind of person who walks around with palpable anger that I cannot stop. And that I escalate and I escalate and I escalate. And I become the tornado. I become the tornado that tears through your life. And the only thing that stops me, honestly, is passing out, right? The way that I drank alcohol was the same. My goal was I was going to drink until my hearts and lungs were working, and that was it. I wasn't interested in any more functioning than that. And part of that reason was because it was really hard work to be me, right? So what is this thing about fear? Right. As I've said before, I had this radical experience, which is that I'd written inventory before. I understood myself to be angry. I never knew how to be fearful. Right. So what happens for me is that I see underneath that anger every time in every resentment, when we look at how we were selfish, when we look at how we were self-seeking, what that's asking me to do is first look at my attitude. Then it's asking me to look at my behavior. It's asking me to look even more deeply at the motivation for my behavior. Then it's asking me to look at my dishonesty. How have I been dishonest with you? How have I been dishonest with me? And then it asked me to look at my fear. And what I found out when I went through inventory that way is that I never gave fear a fair shake. I never gave fear a fair shake. And it seems like I should, because that's pretty strong language when we call it an evil and corroding thread. So it says that we review our fears thoroughly, right? We put them on paper, even though we had no resentment in connection with them. we asked ourselves why we had them. Was it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. And so here's the deal. This is how it was broken down for me, is that if I can think about my fears in terms of things that I desperately protect you from knowing about me. If I can think about my fears as like these core beliefs that I have that I either A, think you already know. And so I'm going to just like try to tell you, I also know, right? Or B, I'm afraid you'll find out. And if you find out the real truth about me, you're not going to want to have anything to do with me, right? I also recognize that like, I wasn't a brand new beautiful baby right? Walking around with this fear that I was a fraud and a phony, right? In fact, I was like my mom's like best dream come true, right? The poor lady prayed for a baby girl for 8 years and I was born, and you know, we've been through a lot. So, but I wasn't born with some of these fears, right? And so I picked them up somewhere, which means that as I'm walking through life, I am desperately trying to protect you from knowing the truth about me. Because if you did know the truth about me, you wouldn't want to have anything to do with me. So what that sounds a lot like is that I'm in constant management mode, right? I'm in constant management mode, as in I'm managing these things so that I can keep you at a certain distance, right? What does that look like at a couple of years sober? What does that look like with a decent amount of time sober? I'll tell you what it looks like. I was sober for 7 years, and I had been in this place where I got married as a direct result of my alcoholism. I got married to somebody in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got married because I didn't know how to solve a problem. And the problem was the relationship. And it wasn't a good idea. And so I got married. And so now what I'm here to tell you is that I'm somebody who's been married and divorced as a direct result of my alcoholism, right? And so what I did when I was in that marriage that wasn't working was I was desperately afraid of the actual fact, right? And the actual fact was this wasn't working, right? But I didn't know what to do about it. I understood what the steps told me to do about it, but now I've got a head full of AA and years of sobriety. And so that means that if I'm honest about this thing, I'm probably going to have to change. And if I have to change, I'm not going to be okay. And so I just continue to block this stuff, and I continue to take these secrets home with me. And then I continue to show up less and less as an effective member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you know me, because you've seen me for 7 years, right? And so my experience with these kinds of fears that clutch me at my being, that feel so offensive to share out loud, those are the kinds of fears that it's probably a safe bet that the thing I'm afraid of might actually already be happening, right? And what it says about fear is that we look at like what self-reliance we had. My experience with understanding my fears is that a lot of times the self-reliant behavior that I engaged in to manage the fear was way uglier than the actual fear. But I don't know that because I'm alone. And so without a fifth step where I'm admitting the nature of my wrongs to you, another person, and to God, I'm left with my own devices. And I don't mean that to say that I'm ill-suited to life. I don't mean that to say like, oh, I'm just a drunk who's wrong all the time. I mean that to say that I need to understand and accept this idea that I cannot do this alone. I might have emotional intelligence. I might even be able to convince a lot of people that I'm healthy and well-adjusted, but where this stuff is concerned, I cannot do it alone. And so what I find is that I never gave fear a fair shake. And I find that the world and its people are really dominating me, not because they're a bunch of jerks, but because I'm desperate to convince you that I'm not afraid and I'm shaking in my boots. So, as I go on, and the book also asks us to focus on the sex inventory. And so there's a couple of things that are interesting here. Actually, I'm sorry, there's one more thing that I just want to talk about fear, right? Because in the discussion on fear, my experience is like really boils down to this sentence on page 68. And it says that we are in the world to play the role he assigns, meaning God. Just to the extent that we do as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him, does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? Okay, calamity, the definition of calamity is a disaster. It is an event. The definition of serenity is it's a state of being, a state of calm, a state of peace, and a state of ease. What I need to recognize about the inventory process is that the inventory process isn't going to make my problems go away, but it's going to help me look at those problems or those events, those calamities. And by doing this and the rest of the steps, I get to become somebody who has serenity so that when the calamity shows up, I can walk and move through that rather than looking for the tornado and like hooking my defects of character into it, right? And so God makes that possible, right? And so as I start to really look deeply at the question of fear, we start really talking about this idea of faith, that if I'm on an entirely different footing, then I can look and see that my behavior is different. I can look and see that these things are starting to change, right? And now about the sex inventory. As I mentioned, I was a violent, volatile blackout bedwetter, right? So it would be a fair assumption for you to think I didn't have a whole ton of romance problems when I walked in. You'd be 100% right. Okay. But there's a couple of things here that I just want to mention. Like the book kind of goes to great lengths to say, look, there's a lot of ideas that are sort of different about this topic of sex. And so what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to do a couple of things. We're going to try to not say something that's going to take a side or an opinion, right? But what we are going to do is we're going to try to talk about this thing in a way that makes sense, right? In a necessary way, right? So when I look at my experience of the sex inventory, it has a whole lot to do with what are the values that I have. It has a whole lot to do with looking at things like my motives, right? So looking at my behavior, right? We put each sexual experience, person, partner, whatever, to the test. Was it selfish or not? Did I unjustifiably arouse suspicion, jealousy, or bitterness? And in this process, by looking at that and also looking at where had I been selfish, where had I been dishonest, where had I been inconsiderate, who did I hurt, all of a sudden what I've seen is that like I understand now. What I'm doing is I'm actually understanding what it is like good behavior, better behavior, by at least identifying the ways in which I do not want to walk through the world. And it's been my experience that if I think about my sex inventory like a conduct inventory, how am I behaving, looking deeply at my motives, then I'm positioned to then go to that same God that's relieved me of the compulsion to drink so far that I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to in step three. That same God that because those things have transpired, I'm starting to believe, I'm starting to have faith. And I'm going to go to that same God and I'm going to consciously invite God into these matters, right? So I am someone who, when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it was 2 months before my 21st birthday. I did a lot of dating. I did a lot of growing. I didn't do a lot of dating. What I did was I did a lot of growing up inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? And so I have this experience of like being early in my 20s and being someone who's trying to date and also actively inviting God into that situation. That's been a remarkable experience. And the reason that it's been a remarkable experience is because where my romantic relationships are concerned, I feel like what happened was I said to myself, I feel like I identified in the inventory process that this is the kind of partner that I want. And what's happened in one way or another is that Creator has showed up with that kind of partner. And then I get to experience what it's like to date or to be with that person. And then I found that like, that's actually not my ideal, right? So again, what happens for me in inventory is that it's not my experience that I just write these things once. What's my experience is that as I progress, as I become a different person, as I start to have more experiences to draw from, I become more in tune with my Creator. And in being more in tune with my Creator, it looks like I have an opportunity. I have an opportunity to walk through things differently, right? I got a head full of AA. I'm pretty sure I'm not supposed to hurt people. But what happens when I get clarity that like, this is not a person that I want to be with? It says, suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and we stumble. Does this mean that we're going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but that's only a half truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things. We believe we will be forgiven and we will have learned our lesson. If we are not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, these we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are the facts out of our experience. So what that tells me is that, like, I'm starting to develop something about, like, accountability, right? Like, we talk earlier in the book about the person who might have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but you can't hold to them because you're drunk all the time. Now I'm somebody who the drink problem is starting to be relieved of. I'm well on my way to a spiritual experience. Now, as I'm well on my way to a spiritual experience, it looks like there's some accountability for me, right? Before, I'd never made a direct line between the way that I behave and treat people and my spiritual fitness and how close or not I was to a drink, right? So my experience is that inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, that's the only place where I can have the thought of drinking and something can sandwich itself in between me thinking about drinking and me picking it up, right? Only inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And so what that means is that I can take heed of these things, right? Is that if my behavior continues to hurt people and I'm not sorry, meaning I'm going to protect it and I'm not going to look at it and I'm going to prove to other people that it's okay, or I'm going to keep it secret, it's a really good indication that I'm sure to get drunk. So when it said in the beginning that this is an effort that we look at our causes and our conditions, I think that it's necessary for me to understand that I don't just look once. And so for me, in steps 4 and steps 5, what I've found to be in really important is this idea that, like, sponsorship becomes a critical element of this journey, right? And as I'm admitting to God and to myself and to another human being the exact nature of my wrongs, what that looks like is I'm starting to have a sense of self. What that looks like is I'm starting to tell the truth about things that are really scary, because I'm starting to build upon this faith. And as I begin to build upon this faith and I begin to start to have this spiritual experience, it becomes clear to me that my problem isn't just locked up in a bottle. And my problem isn't just locked up in the short hand and the short stick that God gave me. That my problem is here. And because I can recognize that these are things that are manifestations of myself, what I'm here to say is that that's the good news. That is the good news, right? If in order for me to get over my problems meant that somebody else had to change their behavior, imagine how lonely that would be. Imagine what a horrible prognosis that would be, is if the only way that I could recover is if those other people got different. My experience is really quick. My experience is really easy with 4 and 5. It's that I am so grateful that myself, my problems manifest in myself, because that means that I have an ability to do something about them, right? And so I had that experience, and this is the one that, like, I'll wrap with. I had that experience of being married to someone and being divorced from someone inside of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was a bunch of time that had transpired between us splitting up, and time had gone on and I hadn't seen this person inside of AA. And I was under the impression that that person had left AA. And that person started showing up to my home group. And I did not want this to happen. I did not want that person to be at my home group. I did not think that person should be allowed to be at my home group. And because it was so clearly a thing that was happening that I 100% did not want to happen, I had at least the gift of clarity that perhaps God was giving me this experience for a reason, right? And so what happened is I went to someone who wasn't my sponsor at the time. And they were like, yeah, she's dead wrong. She should get out of here. You should tell her to take a hike. And I knew that was wrong, right? And so I went to somebody else and they were like, you know, I think probably, like, her motive's this and that. And I knew enough to know that that was wrong. And I actually took this one to a person who works a program in Al-Anon, right? And I took this resentment. I was resentment towards my ex-wife. She showed up at my home group and I didn't think that she should be allowed to be there. And she was really clear. She said, okay, Courtney, you have choices. You can go find another home group or you can work an inventory and get over it. Now, because I did not like at all what she said, I knew that she was 100% right. Right. And so from that moment, I understood that it was my problem because to the precise extent that it was affecting me. Right. I knew enough to know that I have a value that no matter who you are in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want you to walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and find a message that has depth and weight. And I know that in my old home group, you can get that there. And I knew that I wasn't the person that could be there to be the welcome wagon, but I'm grateful that I had the inventory process to walk me through that. And without the inventory process, I'm just holding on to a bitter resentment. I'm going around and around about how this world and its people really wronged me. And here, let me tell you about how right I am. Right? And those things don't necessarily work inside of Alcoholics Anonymous, right? Like I don't get to live in that second column, right? And that's something that I'm grateful for. And this is something that like I for sure cannot do without your help. So I think that is probably all I've got.